Warning, this podcast has stories of real-life events and true crime that happens every day. These stories may contain adult language and graphic or disturbing details not suitable for everyone. Listener discretion is advised. In our society, most people are content to go through their daily lives safely and peacefully. But our society is not always safe or peaceful. For that reason, some men and women answer a higher calling to defend and protect their fellow man. You probably know someone who is one of these people, or maybe you are one of these people. The ones who see and do the things most people would never want to. These things are sometimes heroic and beautiful, but often they are horrific and terrifying. It's these things they don't share about with other people. It's these things they carry with them, so you don't have to. But when they get together, they talk to each other about them. And they call these stories war stories. Welcome to another episode of War Stories. I'm Tom.
And I'm John.
And we're releasing a little late today because it's scheduling conflicts just again. Mm-hmm. We released Locker Room late because of scheduling conflicts, and now we're releasing. It's only a couple hours late, though, so that's not too bad.
It's not bad. Same day.
It's just so much stuff dealing with the new hats.
Yeah, of course. It's the new hats.
It's the new hats.
Sure.
I'm going to blame it all on the hats.
By the way, they look really nice, by the way.
They do look really nice. People should get them. But that was actually kind of a blessing in disguise because at the last second, a gentleman we've been playing, I guess, email tag with on scheduling. Keith, you're with us today. How are you?
I am. I'm doing well. Thank you. How about you guys?
Oh, we're great. Pretty good. You know, every day on your feet above ground, it's a good one. But you hit us up right at the 11th hour and said you were available, so we kind of moved things around and here we are today. So welcome, we appreciate you coming.
Thank you, I'm glad to be here.
Now tell us a little bit about yourself. You are you said 5 years into retirement, and I corrected you and said it's recovery because
exactly.
You're not retired from law enforcement; you're recovering from it.
That's right.
So, yeah, no, go ahead and tell us about your time on the job and where you came from.
Yeah, well, I primarily grew up in Orange County, in Huntington Beach, did high school there, community college and all of that. And when I was, I'm a late 70s, early 80s kid, I loved that time frame, and I used to watch episodes of Adam 12 as a kid, and watched Pete and Jim running around chasing bad guys, driving fast, and I thought, hey, you know what? I think I want to do that. That looks like a lot of fun. I guess even as a youngster, I was an adrenaline junkie, so I joined the Police Explorer program when I think I was about 16 years old. At Huntington Beach PD in Southern California, started doing ride-alongs and all of that. And, as a kid, when you're riding right seat, in a pursuit, it's a white knuckle experience, but it gets the old ticker pumping and it's like, oh yeah, man, I want to do this when I'm 21. I don't want to, if I could have done it when I was 18, I would have, so I went that path. I got hired as a paid cadet at the PD there in Huntington Beach when I was 19. And I did that until I was 20 and a half. And then Huntington Beach PD hired me as a recruit. They sent me through the academy. And then I graduated and hit the streets with my FTOs and got into some trouble as a probationary employee. The standard does not meet department standards, probationary dismissal, you're out type
of thing.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
Yeah, I did some dumb stuff, off duty as, you give a 21-year-old kid a badge and a gun and a bottle of booze and, you never know what's going to happen. On your off time. Yeah. Then I was a school cop for a short time, for I think it was less than a year. Cerritos College in Norwalk. And then I got picked up by Laguna Beach PD and worked for them for 4 years. Lateraled. Well, so I have, when I jokingly say my first ex-wife and my second ex-wife, I'm not joking. So,
oh.
they say the, you know, every cop's got to have at least, you know, one divorce behind their belt. And
yeah, I was always told you're not a real cop until you grow a mustache, drink coffee at any hour of the day, and have your first divorce.
There you go.
Yeah. So,
nailed it. So, anyway, my first ex and I we wanted to start a family. We didn't want to raise kids in Southern California. So we migrated up to Northern California. I worked for Shasta County SO. I did 2 years in the jail, didn't like it. Working as a patrol cop and in an FTO and doing other stuff for 5 years, and then being assigned to a jail, it kind of burst my bubble, passing out toilet paper and, you know, serving food to inmates and that type of thing. So
you get it.
So, yeah, so I left Shasta SO, I lateraled to Butte County SO in Northern California. Chico's the big town there.
Sure.
It's a university town. And the nice thing about them was you didn't have to work in the jail. They had correctional staff that did that. So if you're a sworn deputy, you go, you know, 10-8 straight out to the streets. They give you a take-home car. It was great. And then divorce brought me back to Southern California. I was a sergeant by the time I left Butte County. And I took it was a weird deal, but I took a lateral sergeant's gig at San Jacinto PD, which
is that's pretty rare. A lateral sergeant's pretty rare.
Yeah, yeah. So I did that, went to San Jacinto, and that was in 97. And then in 2004, the city decided they wanted to contract with Riverside County SO to provide police services for the city. They believed it was more cost effective. So, long story short, my hard rank was commander, and I was the acting police chief at the time for San Jacinto. And I had to negotiate for a sergeant's position with the sheriff at that time of Riverside County. So they hired me as a sergeant, and I went from riding a desk back to
pushing a black and white,
around. And then, I never promoted beyond sergeant with the county, which is fine. And I retired in January 2015 and moved to Arizona, where life is great. So
you retired just in time.
Yeah. Seriously.
Yeah.
You retired in time.
Definitely. I've worked everything from a smaller agency with 50 guys to, you know, Riverside County, which is the third largest sheriff's department in California. I've been a ghetto cop, and I've worked for, you know, ritzy fancy places like Laguna Beach PD. So
now you and I talked before we started recording, because you know some of the same people vicariously through the agency that I served with B&E for a while. I heard an apocryphal story, and maybe you can illuminate or tell me if this is true or if you know the guy. There was a creative guy apparently at Riverside County Sheriff when meth labs were all the rage, and he had gone into an apartment complex and they found a meth lab and they took it down. This guy walked left and right from the apartment where the meth lab was at until he couldn't smell a chemical smell anymore. And then he went upstairs and downstairs in the apartment building until he couldn't smell the chemical smell anymore. And then made note of how many apartments were within this chemical smell, basically ostensibly saying that if I could smell it, I know the chemical is present, and I'm not a chemical detector of any kind. And then he added up how many kids were in every single one of those apartments within the smell range of this meth lab, and charged him with that many counts of child endangerment.
Really? What? I haven't heard that one.
I had heard that,
I feel like that could fly.
I feel like if you're really, like, it's at least a stick to hold over them.
Yeah, sure.
For sure. But I just didn't know if you'd heard that story. Because when we were going through clandestine lab investigation school, they were talking about getting creative. And the state guys that were teaching the class had talked about this Riverside County detective, Narc, who had basically...
It's probably true.
...gotten creative and charging with that. So I wondered if you knew the guy.
That's creative, all right. Yeah. I don't think I'd do that. I'd be all hazmated up.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I don't even want to go. I didn't want to go in meth labs, let alone.
No.
Yeah, no, but you'd do it anyway. So so you spent a total of how many years pushing around?
I did just shy of 30 years. It was like 29 years and 8 months.
Wow.
And I couldn't wait to punch out. I punched out on my 50th birthday in 2015. And never looked back. They threw me a retirement party, which was great. I really didn't want one. I kind of wanted to sneak out the back door without a lot of hoopla. And that wasn't the case. And in retrospect, I'm glad I got to see, you know, a bunch of the guys and gals that I used to work with. And they saw me off. They did it the right way. And like within 2 days after my retirement party, we were living in our house in Arizona. And I burned like 2 weeks of leave. When I was living in Arizona, I was technically still employed as a peace officer in the state of California, but we were established residency in Arizona already.
Right, exactly. Right. So, well, we appreciate you being here and being with us. And you had contacted us very specifically to discuss some stuff that we think is pretty important too. So the floor is yours. What's your story?
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thanks, guys. In 30 years, I've had peaks and valleys and my share of hard knocks. I went into the profession knowing that, you know, there may come a day when I may have to pull the trigger. I may get shot at, but you don't think about that stuff every day. You guys know how it is,
yeah.
You're there and have been there, it's kind of there in the back of your mind, but never on the forefront. And when it does happen, it's like, oh crap, is this really happening right here, right now?
Mm-hmm.
The first time I got shot at on duty was, it was actually on a traffic stop in Laguna Beach. I think it was in 89. And I was working graveyard shift and made a traffic stop, cut the violator vehicle loose, and another unit pulled in behind me, and another Laguna Beach officer, Mike Jeffries, and I, we were just kind of, shooting the bull by the side of the road after we let the guy go. And vehicle on Pacific Coast Highway going northbound towards Newport Beach cap a couple of rounds off at us. And so that got my attention. That was the first time I was shot at, but it was kind of a nothing deal. It happened. It was over with. We didn't really get a vehicle description. It was dark. We were talking to each other, and it just kind of caught us by surprise.
And part of you goes, did that just happen?
Yeah. And it was really weird because the area where I made my stop was the, entertainment district of Laguna. There were a bunch of bars on both sides of PCH. And it was a summer evening. People were walking on the sidewalks and having a good old time. But when the round started flying, everybody found a bar to go inside and hide in.
Yeah.
It was kind of eerie. So that happened that, like I said, it was kind of a nothing deal. And it was really weird because I was scheduled to go on vacation the next day. I was taking a 2 week vacation and I did my graveyard shift. Some other stuff happened that night and I drove home, picked up the wife and we're in the car. And I'm driving northbound on I-5, and she's like, "Oh, how was work last night?" I'm like, "Oh, pretty good. You know, I got shot at, and you know, just it was like in passing. You right. know,
no big
normal yet. Normal people don't do that."
No, you're trying to downplay it a little bit. Going, "No, it's fine. It was, you know."
Yeah, yeah. So, I went on with my career, and then you know, worked a bunch of different assignments, worked for a couple of different agencies. And then May 21st of 97, I was a patrol sergeant at Butte County Sheriff's Department. And like I mentioned earlier, we had take-home cars and all of that. And I went in service from my garage, basically. I'm backing out of my garage and my unit and put myself in service over the radio. There's already a foot chase going on of some armed guy that my guys were looking for. So I decided, okay, I'll go over there to Southside Oroville and help my deputies look for the bad guy. Long story short, we end up catching him. We hook him up, send him to jail. It's a super, super busy shift. It was a warm summer evening, like I said, May 21st, a lot going on. And, but there was nothing really out of the ordinary other than that. And, like about 9:50 PM, I'm at the gas pumps fueling up, and I'm talking to one of my deputies who's gassing up his car. And he gets a call of a DV involving a firearm at a residence, and there's nobody else to back him. And, you know, I was a pretty hands-on supervisor anyway. I like being out there with my guys. I'd much rather be doing that than, you know, pushing paper or, you know, handling a citizen complaint or whatever.
Yeah.
So, right. So I speak up for Jim's call. Hey, I'll back. We arrive at the house together. And the call, it was really sketchy the way the call came out. It was, 415 DV, male versus female. The husband says he has a gun and he's going to kill the wife. And then the line was disconnected. So we get there at the house and there's all these kids. There's like 7 or 8 kids in the house ranging from probably 4 years old to 18. And they're Asian, they're Hmong, mm-hmm. like H-M-O-N-G.
Yeah.
And so there
Which
was
is
kind
an interesting
of a
subculture in its own. Like, yeah. There's some interesting stuff. If you don't have Hmong in your community, there's a whole different subculture you have to be aware of with that. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. So we clear the house. Jim and I go in. We clear the house for the adults. And the only thing we could get out of the eldest kid is that, my dad and my mom got in a fight, and they left the house and they're out on foot in the neighborhood somewhere. And we asked about, because when the call came out, it was like, you know, he's threatening her with a gun. So we asked the 18-year-old kid or whatever he is, You know, what about the firearm? He's like, "Oh, there's no gun. There's no gun involved." I'm like, okay. So I get a description of both the male and female. I put it out over the radio, and Jim, I leave him at the house with the kids, and I decide, well, I'm going to cruise through the neighborhood and start looking for these folks.
Sure. And he's going to get all the horsepower and the info and hope, see if they come back, and you're going to cruise around and see if they're around.
Absolutely.
Sure.
So, you know, I get my car, I start driving around, and then Randy Jennings, another deputy who I had just previously left prior to going to the gas pumps, we were on another DV call together. And anyway, it turned out to be a runaway juvenile thing. So Randy stayed and took a runaway report. Well, Randy cleared that call and came into the area where Jim Norman and I were. And he puts out over the radio that a CHP unit had flagged him down and said, and the chippy told him that he saw an Asian male running behind a church at 10th and Grand Avenue, just outside of Oroville in the unincorporated area, not too far from where we were. So I start heading that way and I see Randy pull into the parking lot. And I, you know, within seconds later, I'm pulling into the lot behind him. It's dark. There's a field behind this church with vegetation, dried like brush type stuff. It's probably like 2.5 feet high. And there's a couple trees in this field. Well, as I'm pulling into the lot, I see the male, the Asian, running behind the church. And then I see Randy sprint from his, you know, he opens up the door of his unit and starts sprinting into the field. So I put out over the air that we're in foot pursuit. I jump in the foot chase and try to get some more units there, coordinate everything over the air. And as we're running into this field, it's getting darker because our high beams from our cars were illuminating, you know, this one area where it was super bright, and we're now running into the darkness. Now I kind of lose sight of the suspect, but I can still see Randy running in front of me. Well, next thing I hear is shots fired. I hear rounds go past my head. I see muzzle flash, and then I see Randy, my deputy, go down. And I'm like, oh crap, you know, we're taking rounds, we're getting shot at. And again, it's like this mental thing. It's like, is this really happening?
Right.
It's really happening. Suck it up and deal with it, because you don't have a choice. So I drop down to the ground and roll in the brush, because the suspect obviously knew where I was. I could see that Randy was hit. I put out 1199 over the air, which is, you know,
officer detail,
officer in a gunfight,
send the whole world.
Yeah. Send everybody. And I roll and I hear more rounds going off as I'm rolling, because my intent was, okay, this guy knows where I dropped, so he's going to continue shooting in that area, and I'm going to pop back up in a different location. Because I had concealment, but I didn't have cover.
Right.
It's like tall, dead vegetation. So I pop back up, and then it's like eerie silence. And I know my deputy, my friend, is hit. And long story short, I coordinate folks getting there. You know, we didn't have time to wait and do it methodically. So Jim Norman, the guy that I left at the house, he heard the call for help and he boogied on over to where I was. And then a CHP officer and the three of us went into the field, and we found Randy, my deputy. He was hit. And then we located the suspect right after that. The suspect was deceased. And so we, you know, secured the suspect, cuffed him, initiated CPR on Randy. We couldn't really see exactly where he was hit. We tore his shirt open and ripped the front panel of his vest off, and the fatal round was just above the, it was a weird vest, and he was the only one that wore a vest like that. It was like a V-neck.
Really?
V-neck body armor. Yeah. And where that V came to a point, there was a hole right there. And that.
So right that above was, his sternum, kind of like.
Yeah. Right. So, you know, we did all that we could. I called for Lifelight and all of that. He was medevaced out of there. And it turns out he was hit 5 times, through and through on his left wrist, and it blew his wristwatch off. He took 2 in the front panel and then 1 just above the Kevlar. And then as he was in motion, you know, granted we're in a foot chase. So his body's in motion. And as he was hit and he was going down, he kind of twisted and exposed his back to the suspect, and he took a round in the back panel of his vest. So the vest did a great job other than that one fatal round. So that was probably the worst day in my career, was being involved in something like that and, you know, losing not just a coworker, but a friend.
Right.
You know, I was sequestered and all of that. And, you know, the rollout shooting team with the DA's office, it's comprised of DA investigators and members from other agencies. They interviewed me, and I think I got home at 6 a.m. or something like that. And a couple of off-duty deputies came over to my house. They brought a bottle of booze with them, and we self-medicated and cried and told Randy stories, and they left. And then I decided, well, you know, I'd been up for over 24 hours. I should probably try to get some sleep. And when I laid down and finally started dozing off, I immediately heard gunfire in my sleep. I mean, the nightmare started right away, and it woke me up, and I couldn't sleep. Now, granted, this is 97, you know, the buzzword PTSD,
right?
That wasn't a thing back then.
No.
You know, some people call it PTSD, that it's a disorder. The latest is a post-traumatic stress injury, PTSI. Some people are calling it that now.
Yeah, syndrome, injury, disorder, all these other, like...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Different acronyms. So...
Well, there was a time when it was just combat fatigue or shell shock, you know.
Shell shock. Yeah. So... Exactly.
The names change, but the mechanism doesn't.
Exactly. So, you know, I wasn't really in tune with myself back then. I knew that I didn't feel well, and that I was traumatized, and, you know, just extreme sadness that I lost a friend that way. But I went to the contract department head shrinker, and I got cleared to go back to work. That, you know, I wanted to come back. So he asked me these pointed questions, you know, how do you feel about it? And, you know, I was kind of like, oh yeah, it's horrible. It's sad. It's traumatic, but, you know, I'm fine. I'm fine. That was my standard, response to everything.
Right.
You know, how you doing today, Keith? I'm fine. You know, how was work? Work was fine. You know,
right. What else are you going to say?
Exactly. Exactly. Nobody likes a whiner.
Especially
that's kind of how I, yeah, exactly. Yeah. We're the worst on each other.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, hey, okay.
Don't
this
dig
happened.
The sand out of your vagina and man up.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So I went back to work and during the time that this shooting happened, I was going through a divorce, and I had already had two kids. I had a 1-year-old and a 4-year-old, and my soon to be ex-wife moved back to Orange County in Southern California, to get her old job back with the sheriff's department over there. So, I had already applied to lateral to San Jacinto PD when this had happened. So I'm going through a divorce. I'm in lateral testing process with another agency.
And which is incredibly stressful.
Yeah. And then my friend is killed. You know, I'm involved in this shooting. You know, I had to put on a stoic face that everything's fine, put on a happy face, and, you know, just, I had to live a facade that, you know, nothing's wrong, but, you know,
yeah,
I'd
you
be
can't
driving.
Tank your new job. You can't give a hint that they can't pick you up, you know, because as soon as you hint that you're experiencing any sort of aftermath from an incident like that, that they're going to flush that lateral right down the toilet.
Absolutely.
And did, out of curiosity, did that delay the process for you? I mean, did that kind of...
So it didn't. And to put, you know, time into perspective for you, the shooting was on May 21st. And I started with San Jacinto PD on July 7th.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. So it did not delay you at all.
Less than 2 months later.
Okay. That's good, though.
So, yeah, I went through an accelerated hiring process, and, you know, San Jacinto was really good about it. They let me go to a psychologist in Butte County and do my medical in Butte County. They paid someone to do all that up there, so I didn't have to travel south.
Yeah, some agencies are really good about that kind of stuff. Others, not so much. But
now,
real quick, did you feel any sort of relief or any sort of ability to escape by virtue of the fact that you changed agencies from where this all happened to an agency where you could get a fresh start in such a short time frame?
You know, yes and no. The incident was still fresh. The trauma was still there. I guess just the fact that I was going through a major change and I had to learn my new department's policies, procedures, and people. I had to learn a new, you know, patrol area. That kept me mentally focused, just learning these new things. But the trauma was always in the back of my mind.
Sure. But it provided a distraction so you didn't have to think about it. And you also weren't looking at the faces of the same people every day to remind you of it.
Exactly. You know, I had a lot of support from my guys and gals at Butte County while I still worked there. You know, one of the things that was difficult for me was the location of that shooting behind that church. It was actually, like I said, we had take-home cars. So I'd go in service from my house and I'd drive to sheriff's headquarters in Oroville. Well, I had to drive by that church every day. Every work day, right. I had to drive by that scene. And, you know, for a while after that, there was still yellow crime scene tape up there for like 2 weeks after the whole thing went down. So, you know, it kind of gave me an uneasy feeling.
To say the least.
When I did go back to work, I was overly protective. I mean, I was a new sergeant. I had only been a sergeant for like 6 months, 6 or 7 months when this happened. So I'm learning how to be a supervisor. And now I'm supervising guys that were my beat partners. So that was kind of weird. Mm-hmm. But I had this sense of a feeling of responsibility. Like, you know, their care is my responsibility.
Sure.
And you know, this is one of my guys that I'm responsible for, and now he's dead.
Right.
I had survivor's guilt. Survivor's guilt is a very, very real thing. I mean, three of us ran into that field together, and, you know, I'm the only one that walked out alive.
That reminds me, I didn't ask you, was the suspect self-inflicted, or did your partner get
so Randy got some rounds down range. Randy did hit the suspect, but the fatal coup de grace to the suspect, it was delivered by the suspect himself. It was self-inflicted. He had a little Raven 25 auto, and he stuck it up to his chest and pulled the trigger and finished the job.
Wow.
Yeah. Hmm. So there were a lot of incident, not that, you know, a lot of my guys were killed. Randy was the only one that worked for me, you know, where I was directly involved in, but there were, you know, I was either present or a shooter in several other shootings. Beyond that, you know, I had mentioned that, you know, I was a patrol sergeant at San Jacinto, I made a traffic stop one night as a patrol sergeant. And as I'm walking up on the vehicle, you know, I have my little safety cushion, you know, and all of that. And I'm walking up to the car, I have my flashlight out, and, you know, my flashlight beam made out the very distinct appearance of the barrel of a pistol that was, as I was approaching the driver's side of the vehicle, the guy had contorted his body to the driver's side window, and a barrel started coming out of the window as I was walking up on the vehicle. So he didn't get any rounds off, and I ended up booking it between the front end of my patrol vehicle and the backside of his car, and just kind of indiscriminately got some rounds off through the back window of his car, and he threw it in drive and took off. So, you know, that after that was over with, I'm like, gee, you know, this can't be good. It was a little stressful,
yeah.
But you know, nobody died. And then there was another incident, just outside of San Jacinto, there's an Indian reservation there, and, they're known to, the locals there aren't real pro law enforcement. Anyway, we were pinned down by gunfire for over an hour, me and five wow. deputies, until the whole world arrived. And that was 5 days. That was 5 days before I was to be married to my current wife.
I don't think the audience can understand when you're in a firefight, a second feels like an hour.
Mm-hmm.
So I just want everybody to imagine you take an actual full hour and extrapolate that out when you're, you know, because obviously, you know, once the situation becomes static and starts to settle down, time starts to go back to normal, but then it jumps up again and then it goes back. It changes so fluidly. So to actually be stuck in a situation like that, pinned down for an hour, the amount of things that can go through your head in that space of time is limitless.
With a limited amount Absolutely. Of resources.
Right, right.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you know, trying to stay alive, you know, first and foremost, and then, you know, having that situational awareness and having to, you know, take cover and concealment and coordinate the response to the other inbound units that are coming to help you, you know, there's a lot entailed to that. You know, like I said, first and foremost is, you know, staying alive.
Right.
And not getting hit. But it is mentally draining. It's just exhausting. And that's that adrenaline dump, you know, fight or flight.
Right.
You know, the adrenaline's pumping and, you know, for over an hour. And then after everything's over with and said and done, it's just, it's exhausting. You know, you just want to go to sleep for days.
But then the hard part of the investigation sets in.
Exactly.
And despite the exactly. fact that all you want to do is disappear for a significant amount of time, now it's, I want you to tell this as many times as possible in as much detail as you can in a very short time frame, regardless of how exhausted you are.
Right.
So.
Right.
So that's fun.
So,
yeah, right.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That's super, super awesome.
You know, there's all these critical incidents. I dealt with a lot of death, you know, a lot of car wrecks, fatalities, you know, just stuff that normal people can't wrap their head around. And I say normal people, and that means, you know, anybody else except cops, firefighters, paramedics, and, you know, combat vets.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah. The stuff you see changes you. It has, there is no choice but for it to change you. You don't get to walk away unscathed.
That's right. I mean, you can't unsee it. You can never unsee it. You know, what happened happened. and there's no changing it, you know, for better or for worse. You know, for a while there, it was weird when I was a sergeant at Riverside County working out of Southwest Station. It seemed like there were a lot of, we had a couple of homicides, but we had a lot of like self-inflicted gunshot suicides on my shift. So, guys that
you came were that to work guy. Overtime.
Yeah, I was that guy. They called me Sergeant Death.
Yeah. Oh,
guys that would come to work overtime on my shift. It's like, oh yeah, you're going to work for, you know, on Sergeant Death's team.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, every department's got one.
Yeah.
Like there's the ship magnet, and then there's the guy that's going to get every dead body call from here to Timbuktu.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, you know, in a 30 year career, like I said, when I was at San Jacinto, you know, I got promoted to upper management. That was a different kind of stress in itself, dealing with trying to be a buffer between the line troops and the city manager. And, you know, I had a chief for a while, and then he abruptly left, and it's like, well, you're the acting chief now. So, you know, congratulations, you get to deal with these politicians and mm-hmm. try to educate them on the finer points of police work. So that was a different kind of stress, but I'm writing a desk and not thinking that, you know, I'm going to be pushing a black and white around again, with the sheriff's department, but that's how it happened. We got taken over and, you know, a lot of the really traumatic stuff I was involved in was towards the end of my career, like the last 10 or 11 years, from like 2004 to 2015. You know, I dealt with a lot of death. I just got tired of seeing dead bodies. I went to a murder suicide, and I was the first one there as a sergeant. How does that happen?
Right.
You know? But I was the closest guy, and I went, and husband shot his wife in the back of the head, and then he killed himself. And then we set up a perimeter. Everybody gets there. We had our homicide team come out, and then a couple of general detectives from the station. And I'm like, hey, you want me to walk you through the scene? And this one detective says, he says, I got 6 months to go, and I never want to see another dead body again.
Right.
And I'm like, you know what? I get it. I get it. So my way of coping with this stuff was, you know, I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to talk about it with family or friends because I don't want to be a burden on anybody. You know, I was wound up pretty tight back then.
Yeah.
And, you know, hypervigilant, kind of angry, impatient. But I didn't, like I said earlier, nobody likes a whiner. I didn't want to sound like I was whining. So I just held everything inside. I didn't talk to anybody about this stuff.
But I think there's
other also, than having, go ahead.
Oh, I was gonna say, there's also an element that I found, because for me, it wasn't just not wanting to, talk about it again with them, but also part of me felt like, you know, this area of my life is untainted by that crap. And I don't want to I don't want to poison the well, so to speak. You know, you come home and you talk about it and stuff like that. Which brings me to a question I was going to ask you earlier. When you went home the first time after you'd gotten shot at randomly on the side of the road after a traffic stop, you had said you just kind of mentioned it nonchalantly like it was no thing. And part of me wonders, and I'll ask you, do you think you did that for your mental health to say it's no big deal because you're telling yourself it's no big deal? Or do you say it's no big deal and you mention it nonchalantly because you don't want your partner, your wife, to get poisoned by that? Like, you want to tell her, you want to do the right thing, but you can't actually let her know that it shook you or that it worried you or concerned you. Because if you're concerned, then holy shit, she's going to be even worse. She's going to be a wreck. So you have to downplay it to kind of keep there. At least that's my thought. I don't know about you.
Or is it a...
Yeah, maybe. I think it was a little bit of both. It's like, oh, wow, you know, this is a first for me. But like I said, nobody was hurt. Nobody was killed. So it kind of happened and then it ended. And it was kind of a nothing deal, even though it was like, oh, hey, I just got shot at for the first time as a cop. But yeah, like you said, I didn't want to talk about this stuff because I didn't want to be a burden to anybody. I didn't want anybody to worry. I didn't want anyone to worry about me and worry about the job that I'm doing, you know, and you know what I'm doing out there. I definitely didn't want my wife to worry about me. So yeah, I did kind of downplay it.
Is it?
And she freaked. You know, she freaked out when I told her. She's like, "What?"
Yeah, and you go, "No, it's fine."
Were you?
Oh yeah, it was not a big deal, you know.
But were you so self-aware of yourself and how you were feeling that you were really doing it for those reasons, or do you think that was your body's natural response?
Man, that's a tough question.
And yeah. The reason I ask that question is because a lot of the things that you've explained, I've gone through as well from being in the military and as a police officer, and it's taken me years to be self-aware of myself and my own feelings and emotions. And then now I can think back on prior incidents and whatever else. And I can at least say for myself, that was my natural reaction. I didn't think anything of it in a sense of, I'm not doing this for myself. I'm not doing this for my family. I'm not doing this for anybody. It was just the way I reacted. It was natural to suppress it in the ways that I did.
Yeah,
you don't do it consciously. It's not like you say to yourself, you take this moment to think, I don't want to do this, that, and the other thing. It's almost instinctively protective of,
right.
And you just do it because that's
your reaction. But at the same time, you know, sir, you know, you're older than me. So, you know, maybe at the time you were more self-aware of yourself and you were doing it for those reasons. Yeah, you actually thought about it.
I'm glad you brought up that question, John, because I wasn't self-aware at all back then. I mean, hardly. It hasn't been until recently, like within the past couple of years, that I've become more self-aware, you know, on just what makes me tick. My wife knows me better than I know myself.
Sure.
You know,
my wife will mention things to me that I do and I go, I don't do, what are you talking about? And then I watch for it and I'm like, oh shit, I do.
Yeah. It's funny how that happens, huh?
Right.
Yeah. I just don't think I wanted to be a burden to anybody. I didn't want to get, like I said, when I went into law enforcement, it was in the mid 80s. You know, I went in 85. I graduated from the academy in 86 and then went, you know, 10-8 from there. And yeah, for the non-cop people, 10-8 means in service.
Right. Yeah.
That's what happens when you get around a bunch of other cops. You start talking shop talk and
yeah.
Yeah.
The language comes back.
I just didn't want to get labeled as a, you know, a pansy, or because that was huge back then.
Oh, yeah.
In the 80s in law enforcement, pre Rodney King and all of that. It's like, yeah, suck it up, buttercup, move on, you know, you know, handle your calls, you know, clear the board, you know, And that was kind of my thought process. And then the other thing I was thinking is I don't want to be a whiner. I don't want to be a victim because I'm not a victim. It's a job that I got into that I was fully aware of, you know, bad stuff could happen. So I don't want to be a whiner. I don't want to be a victim. And I don't want to make people worry about me. I think that's where I was at that time.
It's interesting you say you didn't want to be a victim because there is that instinct of I'm not going to let this beat me. I'm not this guy's not going to scare. This is not going to be the thing that causes me problems. I'm tougher than that. I can deal with that. That's please. It's also interesting because one of the arguments, for example, when you talk about you get people to say, you know, Black Lives Matter, Blue Lives Matter, when that whole argument takes place, when it should be just, yes, of course, we all know that the statement Black Lives Matter, you know, matters. And then we also know the statement that police officers' lives matter. And that should be just the way it is. But what I find interesting is the retort that we get is, well, you you signed up for this. You knew what you were doing when you got into it, which you just said, you know, and you just discussed happened. But also they say, well, at the end of the day, you can go home and you can take off the uniform. And I go, well, yeah, you take off the uniform, but you don't take your brain out. You don't take out your mindset. You don't turn it off. The hypervigilance, like you were saying, the need to discuss with family and downplay things and not let them see how much something truly is affecting you. The idea that sometimes you don't even realize how deep something has truly affected you. That stuff doesn't go away just because you hung your uniform up in your locker room, or it doesn't go away just because, you know, you get separated from the military and you go home from your deployment. That argument is clearly somebody who doesn't understand that it's not a job, it's a calling. Whether you're a firefighter or a doctor, or, you know, doctors don't go home at night and not think about patients that they operated on. They go home at night and they worry, did I do enough? Did I save that kid? It's the same thing. It's not Walmart, people. It's not like you go home at night and don't, and just stop thinking about your job. It becomes who you are.
Absolutely. You know, like you said, you know, our profession is a calling, and it's called a profession because we have a code of ethics. You know, the Walmart greeter doesn't have any of that.
Right. So now you dealt with this by writing a book. Is that my understanding?
Well, I did write a book, and it came with some after some turmoil in my life. You know, like I said before, my way of coping was to try to turn it off and go home, and I would drink it away, which worked great until it didn't anymore.
Right.
You know. I was self-medicating so that I could get some sleep. You know, I'd have cop dreams and nightmares and that sort of thing. And I wasn't sleeping really well. So I would, I started with wine, and then I switched to hard liquor. And before you knew it, you know, that's what I was doing every night to get to sleep. And then, you know, let's say I'd have a critical incident at work, you know, I'd go home and get hammered. That's what I did. That's how I coped.
Right.
And, it, you know, they call alcoholism a progressive disease. And they're not kidding. I mean, when I was doing it, I thought to myself, self, this is bad, but you can quit at any time. And I was just deceiving myself because, there's a chemical, reaction in the frontal cortex of your brain when you drink like that, and it changes. And that's when you switch over from, especially if you're predisposed to being an alcoholic, and apparently I am, I crossed over from, you know, being a social drinker to a problem drinker. And in May of 2019, you know, there's a lot of things that I haven't covered. You know, I had a lot of personal tragedy too. You know, my wife was diagnosed with a serious medical condition. We lost both of our fathers, you know, not too long ago. Close personal friends dying and that type of thing. My friends, actually one of my subordinate deputies that I had at my last cop job, his wife was shot and killed in the line of duty, and I think it was 2017. And she worked for Palm Springs PD. You guys may have heard about that one.
Yeah, we heard about that one.
Anyway, her husband Zach works for, you know, my former agency, and you know, that stuff weighed heavy on my heart. So I'd go to the bottle when I'd hear stuff like that, when I'd experience stuff like that. And last year, May 2019, I visited my daughters up in northern Arizona, and I had just lost a friend, and I thought it would be a great idea to, you know, take the edge off. So I crashed my car in the middle of the desert and got a DUI.
Oh, geez.
Yeah. And
well, you're certainly not alone. That's happened. It's sad how many police officers that's happened to. Veterans, police officers, firefighters. It happens to a lot of them.
It does. I know a lot of guys that have gone through it. I sent two people to the hospital, and that was a big wake up call for me. And, they say that there's these pillars of resiliency. You guys have probably heard that stuff already. The DOD, they've come out and they've said that, there's five pillars that we need to pay attention to: mental, emotional, physical, social, and spiritual. We are comprised of all these things as human beings. And I was lacking, I used to work out, and then when I started drinking, I stopped working out. So I wasn't paying attention to the physical aspect, to my mental health or resiliency. I was self-medicating with booze. I stopped socializing with people and just wanted to self-medicate. And then I was spiritually dead too. They say that we're spiritual beings, and it's like, okay, I believe in God, and that's great. That's as far as it'll go, type of thing.
Right.
And so after the DUI incident and the crash, I woke up one day and I was acutely aware of God's presence. It was like this voice in my head telling me, hey, you need to get your crap together. These are the things that are wrong with you. These are the things that you need to change. So it was really weird because it hit me as soon as I woke up in the morning and I got out of bed and I started typing because I didn't want to forget. I wanted to put it down on paper. And I got like five pages worth of stuff that I need to change about myself, my own character defects and in the way I handle problems. And, I started going to AA meetings. I started talking to, doing talk therapy. And then I went through a process. You guys may have heard of EMDR therapy.
No.
Yeah, it's stands for eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, EMDR.
Okay.
And look it up.
Yeah, Google, I'm definitely
going to. When you get a chance. It's real big at VA hospitals, and it's actually been really successful with a lot of combat vets that have PTSD. Well, I did it. And it really helped me. Some psychologists and therapists, I guess there's a license that you have to get certified to use this thing. And for time's sake, I won't get into it, but that really helped me. And I started, meditating. I started working out again. I started making lifestyle changes. My spiritual life got better. I started praying again. I have a relationship with my God. I don't know what you guys believe, but, I have a relationship with my God, who I pray to every day. And, life is good now. I guess the message that I want to convey, to anyone that's listening is, there is a solution.
Sure.
You don't have to let grief and despair and trauma and death and carnage and all of this horrible stuff. You don't have to let it define you.
Right.
I
think that's the moment is when you say, I'm done letting this stuff live my life for me.
Exactly. It's like I said, I don't want to be a victim. We all know those people who are, they play the perpetual victim. And that's not me. I didn't want to succumb to that. I'm like, you need to pull your head out of your butt, guy. Mm-hmm. And it's like God was telling me, this is what you need to do. I'll show you the way. And like I said, I'm blessed now. Life is good. I wrote a book about it. It wasn't all inclusive, thing about my adventures as a cop, I touch on a lot of things in there, a lot of different incidents I've been involved in. I talk about the trauma, the boozing, the PTSD. And,
well, what's it called? So people want to get it.
Yeah. It's called From Sorrow to Amazing Grace, One Cop's Journey. and it was just released in June.
Okay. Yeah. Can you get it on like Amazon and things like that?
Yeah, it's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. I think Walmart's carrying it, Target. You can Google the title, From Sorrow to Amazing Grace. You'll get a bunch of matches that pop up. I have a social media website for the book. It has its own Facebook page with that title, From Sorrow to Amazing Grace. And the handle or whatever name is at Cop's Journey on Facebook.
At Cop's Journey.
So
okay.
if you type make a post Cop's about Journey,
it. Yeah, we'll post on our social media so people can find it. Hopefully get some, you know, if there's people that this is going to speak to, and if this is people that need to read this, or just people that want to read this because they've been there or maybe they don't understand it because they have a relative or something, that this could help. So Keith, we are running a little short on time, but I want to give you the chance to say whatever it is you want to leave the people listening who maybe don't understand, or maybe there's somebody that's sitting here specifically listening to it that goes, wow, that's me. That's me 100% through and through. I got to figure my shit out. What do you say to those people?
I want to tell those people they're not alone. There's all kinds of help available to them. There's resources out there. If they need help, you know, reach out to, you know, a counselor, a pastor, mental health professional, a peer counselor at work. You know, reach out to me through my Facebook page. And, you know, I have all those phone numbers and emails and web pages and that I can't give you right now. But I have all that stuff. So, you can get help.
Yeah.
If you're tired of living like this, you know, there's help available.
Well, we appreciate you coming on, and anytime you want to come on and share more stories, it sounds like we only scratched the surface of some of the stuff. I mean, especially you've got more agencies under your belt than I can shake a stick at. So, you know,
yeah, I'm kind of a gypsy cop.
Yeah. we appreciate it. And, you know, reach out to us anytime. And the name of the book again is From Sorrow to Amazing Grace. Keith, we appreciate it. Mm-hmm. And, for the rest of our listeners, until our next episode, come home with your shield or on it. It's pretty great. I should write a book. I don't know if I have the patience for it, but Keith, that guy's really cool.
I
was
a solid guy.
I really appreciate the story he shared. I cannot imagine. My closest thing to something like that was going, it was literally probably my first week of patrol solo without an FTO. And this young guy who was on our department, he was actually younger than me. And he so squared away, he became a cop at like 19 and was on patrol and stuff starting at 19 years old. And then he got lateraled over to another agency. So the first week I was off patrol, I get off day shift and I go to this party. That's a going away party for him. And one of our partners had gotten a new motorcycle. And another guy was like, oh, you know, I've been looking at getting one of these. And he's like, yeah, you can try it. And he gets on it, goes, bike gets away from him within 20 feet. The bike gets away from him and he smacks a tree as hard as he could. And the tree splits his helmet and separates his shoulder. And I mean, he almost died. We're out there in the middle of this party that's only about 20 minutes old. And he's dying on the pavement with CPR being done by one of my FTOs. And it was
crazy.
So that's not even in the line of duty. That's he's not my supervisor. He was one of my training officers, you know, and I was close friends with him. But to watch that happen to him off duty, you know, within 20 minutes or 30 minutes of getting off work was fucking terrible. So I can only imagine running behind your partner and seeing them take the rounds and then not being able to get to them because
I'm just happy he got rounds off and he hit that fucking guy.
Yeah. I didn't want to say anything at the time, but fucking Randy got rounds off and he got him. Even if it wasn't fatal, it might've eventually been fatal if the pussy didn't shoot him, shot himself in the chest too.
Bitch.
But Jeremiah, thanks for sliding in so quietly.
Right. Yeah. They're coming in a little late. I was like, oh, well,
if you guys don't remember Jeremiah, he's been on previous episodes and he's works with, Save a Warrior is who?
Yeah. I work with Save a Warrior. And then I also do, you know, I've gone through therapy with Bud's Odyssey doing the you know, what Keith was explaining is like the EMDR. I did something similar to that called they call it brain paint for short, but it's neurofeedback. And I was able to like really like relate to, even though like I'm not a police officer, I was really able to relate to Keith's story as far as, you know, like especially like, you know, like when it comes to, you know, drinking to repress
right
everything that's going on. I was just diving right into it. It's, you know, if there's people out there that are like really struggling, or they're, you know, they relate to some of these stories, that, you know, they're getting to the point to where, hey, like I need, you know, some type of help or some type of like outlet to get out of this. Save a Warrior is like the best option.
Yeah.
You know, or one of the best options. Like, and I always like look at it as like, it's like a software reset that as long as you keep on doing the work, you're going to be all
right. 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 You know, writing it all down in a book format has probably been very therapeutic to him. I've sat down and written stuff down and stuff like that, but this works better for me because I'm more of a social person as opposed to a, you know, isolating, type it all out kind of a person. I just can't, like I'm sitting here listening to that. I'm going, man, to have those, when he says he was Sergeant Death, and to have that many right things, and then to find out that the round that got him was literally, it's that little white triangle that we all have when we wear a uniform, whether you're a military vet and you're class B's, or whether you're a cop and you're class B's or whatever, you always know you wear your uniform shirt, and then you're supposed to wear a t-shirt underneath it that's nice and tight, and it creates this little tiny white triangle that just barely covers right below your Adam's apple and above your clavicle, and that's the fucking spot. That's the spot, right? It just, fuck, man, when it's your time,
when it's meant to be, it's meant to be.
Yeah, yep. Exactly. And absolutely, it sucks, but we appreciate Keith coming on. That was the end of our little interview with Keith, but we do have some housekeeping stuff. First of all, the hats came in. You guys, we talked about that.
That's nice.
They're cool.
They're super comfortable.
We have to find a child size hat for John's.
Yeah, because nothing fits my fucking head.
Which is weird because I'm your same size roughly as far as like height and stuff like that. Maybe not weight, but at least height. And I have like a big giant head to where I have to wear a hat size way bigger than what I should, and then you put one on, and even the smalls don't.
Yeah, it sits on my fucking, the bridge of my nose.
Yeah, so we'll get you a new one of that. I just had some, basically some follow-up that I wanted to do on some issues or some emails. So first of all, we had Carlos, who sent us that bitchin'-ass picture of his patch that he got on his helmet.
Sick ass. Right?
So I'm going to post this picture as well, but this was an action shot that he sent hanging out the side of the Black Hawk heading.
Oh, nice.
Badass.
He had emailed us. He says, I wanted to get a picture of me walking away from an explosion, because that's always the coolest way to get it.
Well, for everyone that's listening, what the picture we're looking at is literally as if you were looking out of a Black Hawk while it's in midair with a fire underneath it.
Yeah, we'll post it.
It's legit.
It's cool. I mean, you could tell they just made the drop and they're hauling ass away from it. But he says, Carlos had said, it's not the explosion I was looking for, but the backstory on the picture is as follows. The resident of the home refused to leave, and he and his wife and his dog, well, I don't think the dog had much of a decision in staying, but the dog stayed too.
Dog was probably like, get the fuck out of here.
Dog's like, fuck you people. Despite the efforts of the ground crews trying to get them out and pleading with them to leave, they put in as much work as they could with the ground crew to put some standoff for that house until they were told they had to get out of there. We were working a different area, and the call came to see what we could do. We arrived as everything had engulfed surrounding the building, and the winds were driving the flames toward the house, and the hand crew had bugged out already to safety, so they began a three-ship barrage of water to keep the house from going. I think what sticks out today about it is the voice of the ground crew, shaky on the radios, about his pleas with the individual who lived there and how you could hear the despair in his voice. We will find out later today if the hour of work we put in to stop the advance saved the house. Three ships for an hour. That's a lot of work. And so he sends me a message the following day. It says we got an update. apparently the owner of the house drove to the helibase and talked to the AirTech people. The Blackhawks saved his house. It's fucking closure. It was not easy to sleep last night without knowing if we had done enough. So I read that because that kind of goes towards something we were just been discussing. And so, and another topic that we have discussed numerous times on the show about closure and whatnot. He went home and dumped a bunch, after dumping a bunch of water to try and save this guy's house, or he went back to the crew base and he thought about it all night. Mm-hmm. And he lost sleep over it. So if you think this job ends when your shift ends, you're stupid.
Mm-hmm.
You're a special kind of stupid.
Mm-hmm.
And if you get into this job and you think you're going to be able to get home and not take it home with you, you try,
mm-hmm.
but you're not gonna. It's just, to what level do you, you know, obviously don't go home and drink the entire fridge and
right.
beat the dog and
scream at the wife.
And, oh yeah, that's true. Good. Iced tea is delicious. I love me an iced tea, especially a Long Island iced tea. But, you know, Jeremiah was, it was interesting because you came in a little bit late to the party and I had looked over you when he said the EMDR, I think he said EMRD, EMDR?
EMDR.
Yeah. EMDR. EMDR. And you kind of nodded your head like, yeah, that makes sense to me.
Yeah, no, I know exactly what it is. And like, I've never personally done it. I know friends that have. And, you know, it's like, for me, like when I did the neurofeedback, it's one of those that it rehardwires your brain to where you're doing a I'm not a doctor, so I don't know exactly
how. Oh, you're not?
No, absolutely not. Far from it. It's pretty much like rehardwiring your brain to where the results are permanent.
Right.
So it's the same thing with EMDR. Like, the results are permanent, and because every time you experience a traumatic event, the brain snaps, is like, your brain disconnects.
And it scars.
So yeah, right. Pretty much scars. Yeah, like, right. Just, you know, like as a child, you know, you see something traumatic, you're going to kind of try to avoid like that situation. It's the same kind of thing. What it does is it doesn't, like, it's not invasive to where you're talking about the situation or the event. It's, for me, when I was doing the neurofeedback, I'm listening to music and then I'm watching, you know, and watching like this, like a little screen. And it's like a bunch of like geometric shapes. And it's like, it's kind of like trippy because
it's fucking Clockwork Orange.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, except, only, you know, nobody's murdering anybody.
Instead of, like, instead of showing you terrible shit.
It's not nearly as dark. Right. It's like kind of happy, you know?
Right. Instead of saying kill and maim, it's like puppies and
kids. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Same concept.
Yeah.
Right. It's reverse brainwashing.
Yeah, and it's like, for me, I've noticed that, like, if I get triggered about something or I get angry about something, I'm not just blasting out like I used to. Like, I used to just have such a short fuse on, like, right. The stupidest shit. Like, you know, I get mad about, you know, the dishes not being washed or, you know, like,
right. And it's not, it's just, people don't understand.
And, like, even though I could just be like, yeah, you know what? Just,
but I'm so lazy to do it myself.
Yeah. Just go grab it and take it outside. I'm like, who the fuck did all this? Like,
but that's my point. Like, it's not a rat. People don't understand when you're talking about, I got too angry because the trash wasn't taken out or there were dishes in the sink. We're not talking about like dad coming in and going, I've told you guys 1,000 times, take out the trash and do the dishes. Somebody better get down here right now and do the dishes and take out the trash, or I'm going to start grounding people. And that's a reasonable dad response.
Right.
This is, why the fuck? Like, you're angry, like legit.
You're furious.
Furious about it. And then it's the other embarrassing moment of it is when the reaction dies down and you know what you just did and you're like, fuck.
Well, there's two types of people. Either people that go, fuck, I shouldn't have done that. Or
yeah, you all deserve that shit.
Yeah.
Right. Which, and that's if you're that deep into it,
yeah.
You know, that is what it is. But, you know, anyway,
on a lighter note,
John has information for us.
So we've talked about giveaways multiple times, and it was just kind of just dialing in A, what we're going to give away, and B, exactly how we want to do it. And this was kind of inspired on a picture that we'd already received that I will not talk about, just in case they want to have a submission into this.
I think just the fact they already did it will give them, they were the one who gave us the idea, so we'll give them the free entry.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
So it was Carlos, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Carlos sent us a picture of his, of a patch, of our patch, on his, helmet on top of a Blackhawk. So same set of pictures that we,
yeah, we were
talked
just telling
about
the story
earlier.
From.
Yeah. We posted it on our Instagram. Awesome picture. So Carlos, we're going to send you some stuff. So in that regards, I'll post a video, tonight following this episode's release. And, basically what we're going to do is, anything with our logo on it, whether that's the Ranger panties, shirts, patches, sweatshirts, literally anything, we're going to take photos and video submissions. All you got to do is post it on social media, tag us in it. So obviously we get it, we'll repost it, and then that is your submission. And then by the end of the week, we will pick a winner.
Yeah.
And we'll send you, what do you want to do? Like what? Patch, hat?
Yeah, we'll put together, we've
like
got some Grey Ghost stuff.
Yeah.
To give away, I think we have a knife.
Yeah, knives,
hats. So we'll do like a knife hat. Yeah. We'll do a little care package.
Yeah.
Well, obviously, if you've already got the patch and that's what you're doing, then we'll contact you. And if we send you a T-shirt, we'll get your size and stuff like that. But I think if they post it, tag us in it, and then hashtag fuck around and find out.
Yeah, I like that. That's
great. Hashtag FAAF.
Sure.
And because I know it's supposed to, I know there's an extra letter and I'm dropping an extra letter, but I like FAAF. So if you tag us in it and then hashtag FAAF, fuck around and find out, then that'll be your entry. And every picture will be.
Yeah, submission. Submission. I'm down with that. And yeah. And we're not talking about pictures where, like, you know, where.
Don't be
pictures.
Boring.
Yeah, like
don't be boring.
Like pictures. You were wearing the shirt, and so you just took a picture of your breast, like area. Like no, like make it a nice picture.
If you
we're gonna post these.
If you use the patch as a pasty, that counts.
100% counts. 100%.
Except for guys.
You already know
actually,
what's gonna
you know
happen.
What? No,
the guys. Yeah,
too.
Guys count.
Are my not big enough or what?
No. So if it's get our logo in the picture somewhere. Mm. And it doesn't matter what it's on. And hell, if you haven't bought anything, print our logo out on a freaking piece of paper and do something cool. You know, if you print it on a piece of paper and you get your entire unit or your entire station to, you know, pose with it, thumbs up,
yeah.
And tag us in it, that'll work too. So it's not like
shit. If you can get an entire unit or, you know, your shift or whatever it is in a photo, we'll just send you guys shit anyways.
Hey, I'll tell you right now, I will personally give you a ball cap or shirt of your choice, size and color, out of my personal pocket, if you can get a picture of your logo, our logo, either like on the fire truck in front of a fire or on some dirt bag you're arresting. If you can get some dirt bag to hold up our logo and smile while you're arresting them,
do
not risk your job for this. And John, you can't do it. I know you could get away with it.
100%.
You've already got the stuff, so you don't count. You get your military unit. You get your whole whatever. If you can get something like that together,
that would be
the shit.
Yeah.
But that just you got to make sure that you at us. I guess is the way to put it nowadays.
Tag us in it,
and then hashtag fuck around, find out. FAAF. Other than that, I don't have anything else.
No, we're good to go.
And Jeremiah, you're doing Save a Warrior stuff this weekend, yeah?
Yeah, we're gonna we're one of the beneficiaries for a equine barrel race called Nolan Waters Races out in Temecula. If you guys are out in the area and you want to stop by and say what's up, you're more than welcome to.
Maybe we should kick you down with some patches to.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
To have in
yeah.
case.
No, yeah, I'd yeah. be more than happy to. Yeah, okay. So yeah, I'll be out there. Friday and Saturday. I don't know exact times yet, but I'll be there Friday morning and then most of the day Saturday. It goes until Sunday, and like it's this entire race is geared towards combating suicide. So the young man that is the race is like in memoriam for, he took his life, and what these people are doing is like they donate thousands of dollars to organizations to help people get through stuff. So you guys are out in the area, you're more than welcome to come by, say what's up. You know, you get to meet me. John won't be there.
No. He'll be working.
He'll be working.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll hit you up and
yeah.
I'll go out there with
yeah.
you.
Yeah, no, that'll be great.
And as far as we try to dedicate our episodes, because of our guest, we wanted to dedicate this episode to Deputy Randy Jennings of Butte County Sheriff. because he paid the ultimate price trying to get a bad guy and got some rounds downrange and made the ultimate sacrifice. This job doesn't stop when you do, when your shift ends. So
right.
Until our next episode, come home with your shield or honor.